Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hey, everybody, Michael Steele here for the Michael Steele podcast. I am stoked about my conversation coming up today with someone you may have seen in her infamous kitchen rants, where she passionately explains politics in an understandable, accessible, and witty way. My guest is the incomparable Lee McGowan, also known as Politics Girl. Her work aims to educate, inform, inspire voters to actually participate in this wonderful, crazy experiment we have to re-engage every day in the political process. Don't take anything or anyone for granted. Don't assume anything. And certainly don't assume that the people that you've elected are doing what they're supposed to be doing. She brings all that in order to create a kinder and more informed society. I'm looking forward to it. I'm sure you will as well. My conversation coming up next with Lee McGowan, Politics Girl, right after this quick message. Hey, everybody. You know I've been waiting for this moment. You know I'm just a big fanboy of my guest today. And I was like a schoolboy when I met her at the Webby's a couple of months ago. And now I've done her podcast last week, and she's doing my podcast now. And I'm like, yay, we got
yeah.
So Lee McGowan, Politics Girl, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I feel like we're kind of doing the, you know, red and blue team spirit here. We got both sides happening. Yes. And, you know, like this is the way our country was supposed to work, with compromise and conversation between two sides of the spectrum, right?
Yes, indeed. And I, you know, folks, please, if you get a chance, if you haven't already, go and listen to her podcast, generally speaking. You know, that's number one. But number two, when I was on there, we had such a blast. And there was some stuff that, you know, Lee rightly bemoaned we didn't get into. We're going to pick up that conversation in this podcast. So we're going to cover everything. But I just wanted to say up front just how much from the very first time I saw you, I've said this on your podcast, and I want to say for my folks as well. I just figured, oh my gosh, she gets it. And when I say this, I think you'll know what I mean. You are such a mom, and it is, it, you know?
Honestly, Michael, I take that as a complete badge of honor. Years ago, when I started doing my rants in the kitchen, I did one called America Needs a Tough Mom, right? Because I was like, honestly, the country is at the point where it's like, I'm going to pull this car over, you know? And I used to say, I literally used to say to my son when he was little, when he would be behaving in a bad way, I'd say, come over here. And then I'd take his little arm and I'd hold his tiny little arm and I'd say, absolutely not. And I was very serious and very quiet. And then as he got older, I could look at him and go, absolutely not. And he would know. And then there was a kid just freaking out in a restaurant once, just running around. And this wasn't a kid with any special needs. It was just a kid behaving badly. And he was running all over the restaurant and jumping all up and down and making a noise. And my son, who was maybe four, he looked at me and he goes, that mom really needs to say absolutely not. And I was like, oh, I know, right? And I think the country needs someone to say, like, absolutely not. Like, we've had it. this is not working. We're not doing it. I'm sorry if you're upset. We're doing it like this now. And I think sometimes that's the vibe we all need, where we're kind of like, yep, you're right. You're right. I'm behaving badly.
That's exactly right. We do need that. We need a lot more of that vibe that you're just behaving badly. And the funny part is, you know, how you make all those narratives come into place and how you get them all to connect, to me, is the fascination of politics, girl, because your origin story, I think, really lends itself to two perspectives. One, a more broad perspective, is someone who is originally from Toronto, Canada. So you have that unique perspective of America. And then now being so much a part of the political narrative for the country, sort of a go-to source for a lot of people out there. How first did your interest in U.S. politics kind of emerge? And then what was the moment where you decide to set that camera up in the kitchen and say, you know what, I'm just gonna lay these people out, because this shit has just gone too far for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is exactly it, isn't it? I mean, honestly, I do think the immigrant experience is something unique, because sometimes you really can't see the forest for the trees. I do think sometimes having just a little bit of perspective, I didn't grow up immersed in America. I bought into the idea of America. I moved to America because I believed it to be the land of opportunity, the home of the free, the land of the brave. I really bought the brochure. I loved America. I chose America. In fact, Canadians learn so much more American history than Americans learn, just by nature. But I moved here for what America promised. And then I was living in New York. I moved originally from Toronto to New York, and I was there during 9/11. So that's where I lived. The view from my apartment was the Twin Towers. And watching that city come together, watching the country come together after that event, really made me want to be an American. It made me want to be a part of this country, not just to admire it as an immigrant, but and as a foreigner and as a visa holder, but to really be a part of it. And I always say, which is funny because of course you're a very well-known Republican, I always say that 9/11 made me want to be an American, but the fallout from 9/11 made me into a Democrat. And it was the way it kind of played. Mm-hmm. Now, I am not, probably wouldn't be considered a progressive Democrat. I am definitely a little bit more centrist and moderate than that, more practical, maybe a little bit. I have great hopes. I always consider myself more of a liberal than anything. But when it really comes down to it, the country's gone bananas. I said that I bought into that brochure, right? I moved here believing it. And then when you get here and you really are immersed in it, you're like, oh, geez, we're not what we promised to be. We are not what we tell people we are. We have so many pitfalls and falls, and there's so many people that have no access at all to the American dream. And even the immigration process, you know, we talk about the immigration process all the time. I am an immigrant. How difficult it was for me to get here, I can't tell you. It was so difficult. And I am a white person. I speak English. I am highly educated. And it was incredibly hard for me to find a way to stay in the country legally. So I understand the argument that we need to revamp our immigration system, because I know it firsthand. I also know how important it is to know about America. To become a citizen of this country, you have to take a test. And I often look at the people who are in Congress and I'm like, dude, you couldn't pass that test I had to pass, by the way. You have no idea how this government works. And so ultimately it came down, I started this project to tell people how government works. It was actually after the second Obama midterms. And I was really upset because we'd lost the Senate and I knew we weren't going to get anything passed anymore. And it turned out McConnell did say he was the Grim Reaper and nothing was going to get past him. And I was talking to people at my son's school and no one cared. I mean, no one. Most people hadn't voted. They did not think it mattered. It was a midterm election. And they were like, Lee, oh my God, who cares? You know, like, it's always going to be the same. It doesn't matter. And I thought, oh dear, if these people who have all the access to the information, who have all the access to education, and they have time on their hands, if they're not paying attention, what happens to all the other people who don't have this kind of time, who don't have the background in education, who don't have, you know, the access to this stuff? Well, how are they going to be involved in the political process? And I thought, you know what? I don't think it's just that people don't care. I think it's that they don't understand it, so they check out. When you don't understand something, you check out. And I thought, you know what, let's just dial people back in. Maybe it's just information that they need. So I started literally online civics on YouTube in my playroom. Like, you see me in my kitchen now, but I was in my playroom and I was explaining the Supreme Court and why we do the caucuses in Iowa and what a caucus is, that kind of thing. Right. And then all of a sudden here comes Trump, and my very apolitical, you know, civics pretty quickly became like, dear God, we're not going to really do this, are we? And it became a little bit more opinionated. And those ones really took off. And then when we were coming up on that 2020 election, I thought, well, I'm trapped at home. We're in the pandemic. And I was literally following my husband around the house, ranting at him. And he was like, my love, I love the energy, but you got to put it somewhere else. And I was like, where am I supposed to put it? He was like, I don't know. TikTok. And I thought, I'm not a dancing teenager. And he was like, please, somewhere other than me, if you want to retain this marriage. And so I was like, all right. So I put the phone down in the kitchen because that's where I happened to be standing when I was talking to Sean, and it was right at my level. And I started talking to that. And the amount of people who responded to just sort of common sense way of looking at things, right? They were like, that's exactly it. I was able to kind of put into words what people were thinking. Or I was thinking what people couldn't quite put into words. And like I said, I'm not always coming from a left side or a right side. Right now, I think there is a very distinct way we need to be thinking it. And it does lean more left because the right has gone so bananas.
Right.
But I do think that at the end of the day, it's about common sense. It's about the most people succeeding. It's about the most amount of Americans making it the country that we promised the world we are and that we aren't actually living up to.
Right. That's really what I captured from my first gleaning of your conversation with folks. It was natural. It was unforced. It was basically a mom having a conversation with the kids saying, you know what? Okay, I'm just tired of your crap. Let's get this together, right?
Yeah.
And it resonated and still resonates with people in a way that I think just lends itself to just the authenticity of the moment. And people, regardless of their political landing, the hard-nosed Trumpers, you're not their cup of tea, and you're probably not the cup of tea for even some of the hardcore progressives out there. But that's okay, because the rest of us need it, and it's the cup of tea that we want to go with our scones, and it works. You mentioned the Democrats and being a Democrat, and you've probably heard me, and I think we talked a little bit about it on your podcast. I just find the Democratic Party to be wholly inept right now politically. As I said to a number of my Democratic friends, I don't know how the hell we ever lost to you guys, to tell you the truth. That was not my issue. I won my elections, but the rest of, I don't know how the other Republican chairman and candidates lost to Democrats, since you're so politically tone deaf to what the country is saying and what your political opponents are doing to feed a narrative and a stream of thought that is corrosive, divisive, and at its core un-American. What do you think Democrats are doing that may be working? And what do you think they're doing that absolutely is off the rails, batshit stupid, in light of the realities that we see with not just Trump the person, but Trumpism, MAGA Republicanism, that is now running school boards, running state legislatures, political parties, boards of election.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's the thing. Like you said, I'm not the far left's cup of tea and I'm not the far right's cup of tea. But one of the things that I think is interesting is there's the people that think I work for the Democrats, right? They're like, oh, she's a Democratic shill. I'm not. I criticize the Democrats all the time because ultimately I want them to do better. Right. Like I challenge them to do better. And I would say what's not working is that we are terrible by nature, terrible messengers. I always say that if this catchphrase was Coke is it, and the Democrats had written it, it would have been like, Pepsi isn't it, because there's a lot of better options. And the thing is that we have to understand that we're doing it in the best way possible. And then you should probably buy our product, Coke. Right. And you're like, what? Who wrote that? That's right. Like, you're so just, it's true. Like, it's embarrassing. You know, the fact that your party for years took pro-life as a mantle.
Yeah.
What a stroke of genius. What are you, if you're the opposite of pro-life, what are you? Pro-death? You know, like, we just got slandered with it for years. You know, like, it's, Democrats have all these great ideas, and yet it doesn't matter how great your ideas are if you cannot sell them to the people. It doesn't matter if you're doing the right thing if no one knows you're doing it. So the thing that I would say that we're terrible at is we could be a little cockier. We could be far better messengers. Like, if you look at what's actually happening right now, what the actual real situation is with the Democrats right now, that's working. What Joe Biden is actually doing right now is working, right? Like, people clearly don't realize how critical I am of my own party, but I'm also critical of what I call static politics, right? At the end of the day, I'm a liberal, but I think that we need to be evolving. We need growth. We need movement. And I believe in human rights and human worth. And I believe that government can be a force for good in the world, right?
Now, see, can I put a pin right there? Because as a conservative, I'd agree with everything you just said. You know, I believe in the value of life at all levels, in all spectrums. Again, why I don't support the death penalty, because I'm pro-life, right? So, but to your point about, you know, these things where people are supposed to disagree because you're, quote, a liberal or a conservative or you're a Republican or a Democrat, what we find in actuality is people don't viscerally disagree. Right. And as a conservative, I don't viscerally disagree with what you just said, that I'm not an, you know, I'm not an anti-government Republican. I'm a small government Republican. I think government is a useful tool to provide the appropriate protections for defense and national security, but also the appropriate protections for the safety net for the more vulnerable in our communities. And as citizens, we all have a relationship with that. That doesn't mean I want to magnify the role of government in your life any more than I want it magnified in mine. And so that's the thing that I think what you do in your conversations is right-thinking people, and I don't mean that in a political sense, but I mean people who just kind of looking at the through the lens the right way and saying, this is this crazy experiment, and this is democracy, it's the republic, and we're doing all these things, and we're so diverse, and we all got to figure out how it connects. When they hear what you're saying, or, you know, what I try to get out, communicate out there, hopefully they're picking up on that thing and they make them go, I actually can't disagree with what she just said.
Well, I think it comes down to
that's the aha moment, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, well, and I think the thing is that if people could hear what I was saying, they would find that. And I think that's the problem we find ourselves in right now, that we're in such a dichotomous moment where people feel like they have to sit in their team box. And we're actually, most of us, of course, the far right, far left, we can't do it. And they're on their own extremes.
Right.
But the most of us are working with some form of common sense. I mean, I love what you were saying, that government is a useful tool. Like, I would say I'm a small government, as far as limited government, Democrat, right? Like, right. I don't think we should have endless bureaucracy that goes on and on and on. I live in Canada. You will watch 17 layers of government trying to make a decision, and all it does is end up taking money away from the thing that needed the money in the first place, because you're paying 10 levels of government to do that. I wouldn't. Right. That's not something I would want. And yet you look at something common sense, if we're talking about common sense, I mean, you go back all the way to Thomas Paine, right? He wrote Common Sense. And in his thing, he said, government is a necessary evil. We need to have government if we want to live in a society. Right. And at the time, he was saying, if we don't declare our independence now, we're going to get too big.
Big.
For, right. We're going to get too big for us all to come together. And I sometimes wonder, did we get too big for us all to come together? This is a humongous country. And the people in this part are not the same as the people in this part. And then if you have a state government telling you the wrong ideas, or, you know, we're given money from the federal government to expand Medicaid, and Mississippi says, we don't want your money, you know, and you're like, well, can we really work together? And I would like to think that we can, you know. Right. I think that your party with Ronald Reagan caused us endless problems for many reasons, obviously. But I think his words that people keep going back to, that I'm from the government, I'm here to help, is the worst words that you could ever hear. I think it did us such a disservice, because I do think that the government can help. And when you asked me originally, what is the Democratic Party doing right? I would say right now, they are showing us that government can help, right? You are on a different side for me for the Affordable Care Act. Now, the Affordable Care Act has actually saved my life. I have a very serious disease. My husband and I both work for ourselves. Right. So without the ACA to protect my pre-existing condition, and without the exchange to get our healthcare from, I would be dead in America.
Right.
So the government helped me, and they helped millions of other people with that one piece of legislation. The recent Infrastructure and Jobs Act, people mocked Joe Biden for thinking he could be doing anything in a bipartisan way, right? But he did. And that bill is literally rebuilding a crumbling America that hasn't done any work.
And it's putting people back to work.
It's putting people back to work, right? It's giving people broadband, which is now like giving people electricity in a modern world. Like, we need that. It's essential to function. So the government is doing that for us. And the CHIPS Act was passed. It's bringing back manufacturing to America. That's not just building factories. That's going to be putting people back to work. So these are things that I think the Democrats are doing right, because they are actually delivering on things that will help the people. The question is, can they explain that in a way that makes people go like, oh, really? Like, that is what I would like to see more of that. Because I do think that if we could show people government did work, then we could get back to a system where your ideas come to the table and my ideas come to the table. And we're not bringing like Mr. Potato Head to the table. We're not bringing Dr. Seuss to the table. We're not bringing Hunter Biden's laptop to the table, because that's not going to help Americans. Right.
Exactly. The next place I want to go with you, which I think is pretty fascinating, is, and then keeping in line with the conversation, your channel, your YouTube channel, your podcast, all of those are aligned with this idea, as I said, of educating regular folk, everyday folk, not in, you know, a condescending way and all. It's like a mom talking to the family about things that they may not understand as well as they should, or things that they may be not aware of, or things that they know a lot about, and you have a chance to sort of put some context and perspective around it.
Well, I mean, honestly, Michael, what have we been told to not talk about our whole lives, right? Politics and religion.
That's it.
What are the two things that cause the most problems in the history of the world?
Politics and religion.
So what the hell are we doing, right? Like, the only people that benefit from us not talking about those two things are the people in charge of those two things, because they can kind of do whatever they want if we're not watching them. And so I think we should be talking about politics all the time. I tell people all the time, like, politics affects every part of your life. It affects how fast you can drive. It affects whether you can leave your house during a pandemic. It affects whether you can, you know, die during a pregnancy or not. Like, right now, there is nothing you can look around and not see politics has a part in. So to think not paying attention to politics means politics doesn't affect you, you're kidding yourself. It just means you can't affect it. So I feel like we all need to be discussing this. And like you said, I don't want to talk to people in a condescending way. I have no interest in people thinking I'm the smartest person in the room.
Right.
I want them to feel like the smartest person in the room. I want them to go into a cocktail party and someone says, oh yeah, by the way, it's Biden's fault the inflation is so high. And they go, well, actually, America's inflation is the lowest of all of the, you know, European nations and G7 right now. We're doing the best of all the other countries.
Right.
People be like, what? You know, like, I want people to feel smarter about that. Like, we're actually doing very well. I want people to know of which they speak so they can go out into the world and share it. If we're out there talking to our people, talking to everyone about this, this is when we can start to make real change. And that doesn't mean that I just always get my way. That's not real change.
Right.
That it means that we start making decisions that affect all of us by all of us, not just by a couple people at the top.
So you had a good example of that recently. I want to play a small clip from your July 5th Politics Girl posting on Twitter regarding the upcoming August 8th special
election
in Ohio. Let's take a listen to that.
On Tuesday, August 8th, Ohio has an incredibly important special election with just one thing on the ballot, a measure that will raise the threshold for Ohio citizens to amend their own constitution from a simple majority to a supermajority. The Republicans are doing this in response to what they think will be a citizen-led measure to codify abortion rights into their constitution in November. So instead of letting the public vote on what they want and letting majority rule, they've decided to sneak in an election before November, which would essentially destroy the ability of the majority of Ohio citizens to have their voices heard. A 60% threshold for a constitutional amendment would mean that Ohio now had a system where 41% of Ohio voters were able to stop what 59% of Ohio voters wanted. Does that sound fair to you? No. It sounds underhanded and anti-democratic and exactly in line with today's Republican Party. It's minority rule.
And that in literally 57 seconds, you encapsulated exactly what August 8th is about in Ohio. How do you do that? I could say for one sense, yeah, that was the 75th take of sort of doing that. But I don't get that vibe from, I know that these things do, you do edits for purposes of, effect. And sometimes, I want to clean that up or say this differently.
Mostly we just edit out my breaths because again, I did start on TikTok. So it's mostly see me breathing.
Exactly. Well, you're breathing.
In real life, I breathe. I write it down now, of course. And so I only do one or two takes.
Right. That's not really my point. I don't care about the logistics of it and all that. What I cared about was the fact that in 57 seconds, you were able to convey not just an idea, but the substance of that idea, ask the question that would cause the listener to ask themselves, do I agree with that or not?
Right.
And that is the essence of political education and beating back against disinformation. When you're in those moments in this Ohio election, I guarantee you most people don't know what's happening. Most people are unaware that this is a setup pitch for what we're going to see coming in other states. I've been trying to warn Democrats and people in the democracy space for some time now of what the underlying strategy and narrative emerging out of MAGA Republicanism is about. Mm-hmm. And what its end game is. And this is one of those plays.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about the value of what you do in that moment and why you do it the way you do is so effective.
I start from my own understanding. So if I'm confused about something, what I try and do is I don't do the news. I explain the news. I put things in context. I think there's a lot of people out there who are doing the news. That's great. Do your thing. What I try to do is take things that I'm hearing about, but I might not entirely understand, and then figure it out until I do understand, and then put it in a way that other people can understand. Because ultimately, that's the point. We want more people to understand. I recently just did that with the Trump indictments because I was like, why are we talking about Clinton's sock drawer? And then we're talking about classified, declassified. And then we're talking about we're talking about the Espionage Act. Like, what? And so I went and I researched it. And I was like, oh, geez, there's three different types of documents. They're not even the same legal doctrines. You know what I mean? There's like agency documents, and then there's presidential documents, and then there's personal documents. And I had to get my head around it. And then I was like, now I can explain it to people. And then people say, holy hell, I had no idea. And I'm like, why would you? No one's explaining it to you. The media is not doing it for the most part. They're not like, okay, let's just break it down, because it doesn't sell, and it doesn't sell advertising. And I don't answer to an advertiser. I don't answer to a board. It's me and my own brain going, what matters? What are people talking about? What don't people understand? What don't I understand? And what's the best way for me to break this down for people? That's why the Democrats are struggling, right? Because I've talked to them too. And I've said, what are you doing? Like, people don't understand. And they say, Lee, you have to understand. We're like an aircraft carrier, right? So for us to change directions, it takes a really long time to go one degree.
That is absolute bull. Absolute bull. I came into an organization in January of 2009, formerly known as the Republican Party.
Right.
And sitting across from me down the street was the first Black president of the United States with a 70% job approval coming in the door. I'm looking at a base that is splintered, pissed, and uninterested in anything that the National Party has to do or say. I'm watching donors run for the hills following Bush and Karl Rove out the door. I'm looking at political parties across the country, right? Across all 50 states. Do you know, out of 50 state parties, only 12 had websites in January of 2009?
That does not surprise me.
And I'm walking in the door. I've got special elections coming up in the state of New York that spring. I've got two ostensibly national elections for governor in New Jersey and Virginia that fall. So don't sit there, tell me, DNC, that, we're like an aircraft carrier. It takes time to change and reposition. No, it don't. This is politics. This is not the seven seas of the world.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You want to move that bitch, you turn it. That's what you do.
And that is what I think too. And the thing is that this is where I differ from, you know, the people who are in charge of my party, and probably why they don't pay me, right? Because I do believe it could be done differently. I do believe, I said, okay, well, unless you're going to let me steer this aircraft carrier, then you need to have speedboats off the side. You need helicopters off the side, which is why we're leaning on people like Swing Left and NARAL and States Project to do this kind of outreach that we need to be doing. I was working with a candidate in South Dakota who was running. He was running against John Thune, right? And John Thune is like McConnell's right-hand man. And I was like, here's the thing. He's like, I said, are the Democrats helping you? He said, well, they're not actively funding my opponent. And I was like, we've completely given up on certain states. And I really do believe there are more people in America who believe in human rights. There are more people in America who believe in women rights. There's more people in America who believe in minority rights. There are more people in America who believe in the LGBTQIA+ community than there are Democrats talking to them. And so if they're not going to do it, then I'm going to do it. And I'm going to encourage other people to do it. And I'm going to encourage the other people who are listening to me to do it with their people, because I do not think that we are screwed. I do not think we should just give up the ghost to this wannabe authoritarian Christian nationalist party just because they're better organized than we are. I refuse to do it. Like you said, how did we lose to these people? Well, A, we have better ideas, but B, there's more of us. And so we need to talk about it. And I actually think there's more of us that are like you and me. Like, yeah, okay, we might not agree on every policy, but we're like common sense people who want good things for our country.
She's the politics girl, Lee McGowan. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to go through a little checklist that Lee and I didn't get a chance to go through the last time we were together, and which she lamented at the end of her podcast. We didn't get to talk about the candidates. Well, guess what? We're going to talk about the candidates with Lee McGowan, politics girl, right after this quick break.
I'm Rick Wilson, host of The Enemies List. Every week on The Enemies List, we talk about the things, the people, and the issues that are breaking America and what we can do about it. I have conversations that are about a half an hour long with some of the smartest people in America. We're not just looking to criticize people. We're looking to figure out what the hell we're going to do with this country. The Enemies List is a fast, compelling conversation, and I hope you'll join us. Like, subscribe, wherever fine podcasts are sold. You know the drill. The Enemies List, produced by Resolute Square. I'm your host, Rick Wilson, and I hope you'll join us on The Enemies List.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm having a blast. I don't know about you. This is my gin and tonic for the day. This is it right here. My lady friend, I love her to death, Lee McGowan. She is the politics girl. So Lee, we had fun the last time. And you and I, as we want to do, we just go on these rants and these screeds and we have fun and we cover a lot of topics, but we didn't get to.
Yeah.
Which you really wanted to, the 2024 presidential candidates for the Republican National Party. So let's get into it a little bit and get your take. And I'll share a few thoughts along the way because I know you're interested.
Well, you know, it's so funny because you guys, the podcast I'm on with Michael, I had Michael on my podcast, the Politics Girl podcast. So you can already listen to that. This is kind of part two of that conversation. Right. But the two of us were really keen on this stuff. And I'd had him on. I was like, we're going to talk about the candidates. And then we just got too chatty about America. We never actually got to the candidates, which, you know, ultimately we said makes sense because it's hard to defeat Trump as the nominee. He's the nominee. So why are we even talking about any of these other candidates? But ultimately, you know, we do have to discuss them on some level, even just to say, like, what does the Republican Party represent now? You know, every sort of aspect of it is represented here.
And that's exactly it. What do they represent now? So at the top, and I just don't even, I think it's very clear how we feel about Trump. So I'm not even going there. Let's just say, from my position, if anyone is ready to become the nominee of the party, then take him out. Until you show me you can do that. But we'll have fun. So, Ron DeSantis.
Well, as I said to you on my show, Ron is just a god-awful candidate, right? I mean, he's terrible. He's a terrible leader. He's a terrible man. And he's just an awful, awful candidate. I think the billionaire sort of donor class of your party wanted to support him because he was, as I said to you before, you know, Trump through a car wash. Those are Rick Wilson's words, right? But ultimately, same thing. Ron's somebody's puppet. He's somebody's puppet. He's a billionaire's puppet. He's his wife's puppet. You know, he's without personality. He's a bully. He's a coward. And he just doesn't have it, right? And I think we also just have to look at how well the country's doing right now. Like, Joe Biden's economy is doing great. And Florida's economy is the new inflation hotspot in the US, right? Do people really want to scale up that operation? Do they really want to scale up the operation of LGBTQ people going to the hospital and being turned away? Do they really want to scale up the operation of women bleeding out in parking lots because they can't get the medical care they need? Do they really want to scale up not teaching African-American history? Do they really want to scale up what Ron DeSantis is doing to Florida, which honestly is pretty awful? And I think that in its own right is like, what are we even doing here? The man is absolutely a dictator wannabe.
And you put your finger on a very important aspect of his campaign. I had this conversation last night at an event here in town with some of the folks I was chatting with. And I noted that the interesting thing about DeSantis and really kind of the media's sort of shock at just how much he's failing and flailing about is the fact that he is not a creature of the base. He is a creature of the donors. And that's the difference. They're the ones who wanted him. You didn't hear MAGA Republicans or even mainstream Republicans for that matter running and falling all over themselves to put him out in front ahead of Trump. They did not. They will not. And the reality of it is he is a creature of those donors who are now, like Murdoch and others, having second thoughts about the investment that they started to make, watching that investment basically pile up in the corner of the room and beginning to smell like stuff that piles up in the corner of the room.
Yeah, they should have invested in Casey.
This.
She's the powerhouse there, baby. She's the one that wants
it. There is that. Tim Scott, South Carolina.
Senator. All right. Tim Scott is an interesting choice because he's connected to Larry Ellison and the Koch network. So he's got kind of that same donor backgroundy thing. Right. And he gives any sort of racist Republican a way to say, here's my black guy. Like, you know, but as a man, I feel like he's bought and paid for. I mean, I think all these candidates kind of are, but this guy just seems a little bit more gross because he panders to people who really hate him. And I find that deeply unfortunate. And at the end of the day, I don't see the current Republican Party actively embracing white Christian supremacy, voting for a black man for president. I mean, do you? Because in
especially one who's not married. So yeah.
And in many ways,
kind of
what we're seeing right now is a reaction.
The whole family values conversation.
Yeah. Well, this is true. This is also true.
But the race thing for me is a particular sticky point. I of course know Tim very well and was very proud and excited and happy to work with him and his team in 2010 to get him elected to Congress. Same with the next person we'll talk about, Nikki Haley. But the problem I have is you can't tell me that, you know, push back on people saying who have concerns about the racism in America and then in the next breath complain about being racially profiled by police on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
And so either that America exists or it doesn't.
Right.
So you either got racially profiled or you didn't.
Right.
And if you did, then there's racism behind and beneath and within and between all of that. So I think that sort of to your point about trying to placate and play to a white conservative base that has elected him in every election, does not translate nationally when you run into a black community where they're mourning the loss of a young black man who just had an encounter with the local police, or a black couple that did not get the loan for the house because they didn't, quote, qualify, and neighborhoods that are disintegrating because they've been redlined by white majority-owned banks. So the reality of it is you've got to address those truths for those communities. And if you don't, I don't know how that translates. Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina.
Yeah, if I just made with Tim Scott, he also isn't resonating with people like me. I mean, I'm the white community and I don't think he's acknowledging what is actually going on. We actually we've built a country around racism. And if we don't acknowledge that, we'll never be able to move anywhere past it. And, those policies don't necessarily affect me the same way it would affect the black community. And I'm well aware of that, but we need to talk about that. I think that's essential. Mm-hmm. And if he's not going to do that, then he's missing the moment. Nikki Haley's such a disappointment to me. I mean, theoretically, she's this powerful woman. I love to see women in power. She's executive. She's got foreign policy experience. She's worked in a presidential administration. She has a sense of that. But to me, she just feels like such an empty vessel, you know, mm-hmm. that she'll kind of do or say whatever it takes to move ahead. And she ultimately just sort of stands for nothing. And I don't trust her. And I'll probably honestly never get over the $52,000 she spent on drapes for an apartment she was going to live in for like a year. I just, you know, if you go back to being like a mother, I'm like,
right.
Nikki,
that's
irresponsible.
Your mom calls you.
Yeah, I'm like, Nikki, no.
What did you just, spent what?
On what? When you were cutting $350 million from peacekeeping at the UN? I don't think so. You know, like, no. Impractical. And I want to support powerful women doing their thing. I really do. But
yeah,
she's a disappointment to me.
Former Vice President Mike Pence.
Oh, I don't think Mike Pence has a chance. I actually don't even know what he's doing, right? Like, why would he put himself through this? I mean, I appreciate that he is finally speaking up and saying that the vice president has no right to pick the winner of the election, because my God, if the vice president had the ability to do that, wouldn't have Al Gore chosen himself?
Would have made it
right?
A lot
like
easier
it makes
for
no
him.
Sense. That makes no sense. But it all feels like 2 years too late. He's also very limited in the personality department, and I don't think he has a leg to stand on with the Trump people. Right? They hate him. They wanted to hang him, and it's hard to come back from that.
That's to me is the central central point. To go back to Nikki Haley for a moment, the defining moment for me was the way she handled the Confederate flag issue. And then that's all since been redefined by the way she's handled her presidential run. Mm. That old Nikki Haley that was someone I helped get elected, who stood in the face of racism and segregation and Confederacy and said no, then goes on and placates a guy who says they're fine people on both sides. I just have a problem with that. Mike Pence, the bottom line for me on Mike Pence is they wanted to kill you, dude. So, okay.
Moving on.
Yeah, Chris Christie.
Well, Chris Christie is, I think he's the most interesting to me because he's actually taking a stand against Trump, right?
Right.
He's the only one, and I know you love this word, but with the cojones, right? He's the right. only one who is being honest about Trump and taking him on directly. And the rest of the group just kind of feel like side dishes around the Trump main course. And at least Christie's offering us a different meal, right? But I'm pretty sure whoever wins is going to have to promise Trump a pardon if he's going to let them move forward, right? And Christie's been pretty sure that he's yes. not going to do that. But I, you know, like I'm like, but, you know, Christie's saying, oh, I would never do such a thing. But I'm like, yeah, he probably would. At the end of the day, Chris Christie does what's best with Chris Christie, right? Like whether that's shutting down a bridge or shutting down a beach, you know, like he helped grab him by the pussy, you know, with the debate prep, right?
Yep.
Like he got COVID because of it. Like he might be critical of Trump now, and I'm totally here for it. Like, don't get me wrong. But he started off his book tour defending Trump, and now he realizes he might have a better shot at winning the presidency if he's criticizing him. So although I like it, it's disingenuous. But I do appreciate hearing at least one person in the leadership position of this party speaking the truth. But it doesn't really make me trust him as a leader. And if I'm being honest, like, does the GOP base even want to hear the truth? I mean, can you win by being
honest?
No,
they don't. They don't. And it kind of goes back to the Tim Scott conundrum in that he's singing Reaganism and Kumbaya, and the party is like, dude, I just want to burn things and kill people.
Exactly.
I don't understand.
Jesus, turn the wheel, DNC. Like, do right. not see it.
I just don't. North Dakota Governor Doug Bergman.
Okay, well, listen, Doug Burgum, Perry Johnson, Ryan Binkley, they're all kind of this same take on like businessman, religious man that end up kind of being like nothings to me in this race.
Right.
I mean, do you have a different take on that?
No, I think you nailed it, and I had no comment at all on any of that.
Honestly, I it's
but
also
I had that. I wanted to, you just lumped you. I didn't even. I mean, let's just Burgum for all of that.
Yeah, I mean, like I'm pretty sick of rich people running for vanity projects because they can pay for it themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, I really wish we could just get money out of politics because then we could actually listen to the candidates' ideas and assess their morals rather than measuring their wallets. But you know, here we are.
Will Hurd.
I like Will Hurd, right? I don't mind Will Hurd. I mean, I wouldn't vote for him because I'm a liberal, but his experience as a CIA officer, his time as a congressman, he lived in a border district, so he kind of gets that national security immigration thing. But there's no way this guy wins the primary, especially since
I think Will now creates an interesting opportunity for the party, should they pivot off of Trump.
Yeah.
To have
him and Asa,
like Will Hurd, have a Will Hurd on the ticket.
Right.
I think substantively he lands a little bit better than Tim Scott, a lot better than Tim Scott, actually.
A lot better.
And I think Will is one of those guys I'm looking at less in 24 and more in 28 as being sort of an interesting bird that will develop some real wings and fly. Governor Asa Hutchinson, whom I have deep admiration for, having worked with him in the past at the RNC and even before that, he is the quintessential Don Quixote candidate. But I don't see him so much chasing at windmills as I see him trying to point out that there are windmills and that you better be careful when you run into one.
Right. I mean, listen, to me, Asa Hutchinson is the one that makes me the least anxious. Right. He's the one that feels the most like a classic Republican choice.
He is. He is a classic Republican
choice. Yeah. He's, you know, he was U.S. attorney. He was a congressman. I don't love that he was Bill Clinton's impeachment manager. Right. But he worked for the DEA. He was the governor of Arkansas. I feel like he's the kind of guy that could come up from behind as a real Republican candidate. And I like the idea that he's at least expressed some unease with the way the GOP is going. And I feel like someone like him might have a real chance in a general election. But again, he'd have to win the primary, right? Yeah. And despite the fact that I'm sure a lot of people would love to go back to the conservatism of the 90s, that's just not where your party is right now.
Vivek Ramaswamy.
Well, speaking of measuring your wallet, right? I mean, oh, okay. Look, Vivek wouldn't be running unless he was rich, right? And again, I am so over people's entire platform being, I'm a rich dude. And also, I'm anti-woke, right? Anti-woke means nothing. We wouldn't even be listening to this guy if he wasn't buying himself airtime on TV. He's running in third place right now, you know, like above Pence, above Haley, above Scott and Chris. Like, that's nuts to me. Who is this guy? But also, like, who cares? Because it won't be him, right? Like, so if your whole deal is being anti-woke, I'm not sure how you're supposed to beat DeSantis, who, you know, but like,
who's the king of woke?
Who's the king of woke? You know, like, he, that's where woke goes to die, blah. You know, like, I don't know what we're doing here. And I just, I'm so sick of these dudes buying themselves respectability when it doesn't belong on their shoulders.
So last one is the good mayor of Miami, Francis Suarez. He's another one. I've had the fortune of meeting him and chatting with him over time. I like him a lot. Always, when I put my chairman's hat on, I look at a guy like him and go, okay, yeah, we could polish this. We do a little refining there. The messaging could be tight. Boom, boom, boom. He's a player. I see him again as another 28 prospect positioning today for that, as opposed to really kind of doing the, make me the nominee in 24.
Yeah. You know what? It's interesting. Suarez is interesting because I like that he tried to help people not get COVID as mayor of Miami, right? And that put him in DeSantis's crosshairs and again in the base's crosshairs. So I'm like, okay. But like, I don't feel like this guy's running to win. I think he's running to raise money and put it in his pockets. Like, the whole thing feels a little money laundering to me. And I'm glad if you don't think that. He doesn't seem to have a clue on international issues. So if you want to be the president, he's going to need a lot of polishing. I mean, that's lot of polishing. But even Hugh Hewitt was like, dude, like, you don't know who the Uyghurs are? Like, you know?
Yeah. Well, there was that moment. That's what I was saying. It's like, you kind of look at it. Yeah, okay. We need to
Get polishing, Michael.
Get polishing quick.
We'll talk about him in 4 years.
So,
but here's the thing. We will only talk about these potential candidates in 4 years if Trump doesn't win in 24, right? Because if Trump wins in 24, we're not looking at an election in 28. It's certainly
There will be no election in 28.
No. So like, let's not pretend, right? Yeah. Like, look with clear eyes and no wool on them at what happens if Trump does get reelected, right? He and his allies are incredibly clear that their goal is to consolidate power around the president and limit the power of anyone that could hold him back, right? It is terrifying. And if we don't get together, left, right, centrist, whoever, and realize that this is a real moment where we really are deciding between an autocratic Hungarian Russian type government or an American democracy that has problems and needs work, That's the choice. It's not between Biden and Trump.
I want to get to before we scoot, because I want to make sure I get everything in on this one. But then again, maybe I'll skip some things so we can talk again.
I had to, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you did an observation on the Supreme Court, which again I thought was straightforward and very compelling. And I want to play a little bit of that clip so folks can get a taste of what we're about to talk about.
The Supreme Court is facing a major legitimacy crisis. We currently have 9 unelected people who have been given ultimate say over all of our rights and our freedoms. They have no oversight, no term limits, and nothing and no one to hold them accountable. 3 of the 9 were given lifetime appointments by a twice impeached president who tried to overthrow the government and stole top secret documents from the White House. 6 of the 9 are deeply tied to the far-right theocratic dark money Federalist Society, who has spent 40 years trying to undermine the rule of law for their own version of who matters under the law. These same 6 justices were all confirmed, claiming definitive respect for settled precedent, but are now ruling that established laws and rights can be overturned on a whim. This is the same majority who gets to decide what cases the court even takes up and how, and have expanded the shadow docket to take more cases that are decided away from public scrutiny with limited preparation and no oral arguments. Despite the fact that the Supreme Court is supposed to be removed from petty politics, these justices are out campaigning with right-wing politicians, taking speaking engagements at right-wing events, and indicating to right-wing groups which cases they would like to see come before them.
We can disagree, and I don't in your telling of that, with that analysis and interpretation of you know what you're seeing, but the facts kind of support what you're saying. The preciseness of it around something that is real. I mean, people think the House and the Senate and the White House are nebulous to voters out there. The Supreme Court is like Oz. it is this, you know, place behind the Golden Gates where, you know, it's, you know, everyone's, you know, singing loudly and there's a very, very little understanding of what the role of the court is. People don't know that the court has been as large as 10 justices or 12 justices and as small as 6. So the number can vary. It's not fixed constitutionally to 9. That's not a silver bullet or a magic number. That the court has, unlike every other federal court in the country, it is the only one without ethics rules, requirements, and procedures that must be followed. There's not a federal judge in this country could do what Clarence Thomas and Alito have done and still be sitting on the bench. Not one. And I think that's the important thing for people to understand here. There is not a federal judge in the entire system who could do what they've done with donors and trips and getting their kids' educations paying for their mom's homes and still be sitting on the court. There does not want. So talk to me a little bit about your approach to that and the kinds of solutions that you would see as sort of important in sort of changing a court's the opinion that we have a court that has fallen from 70% approval among Americans to roughly about 29% today.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's understandable, right? I say at the beginning of that video, the court is facing a legitimacy crisis. And the thing is that this isn't politics. At the end of the day, if we want to live in a country with law and order, we have to believe that our justice system are arbiters of the truth, that they deal in facts, that they're not corruptible. And it is impossible to see that if you see justices on people's yachts and private planes and then ruling on their cases. You know, that is the most, we can't possibly think that's fair.
Right.
And the problem is that it's not just that they don't have any ethics rules and they don't answer to anyone but themselves. And they can choose to recuse themselves or not. You know what I mean? Like Clarence Thomas chose to not recuse himself when his wife, you know, was basically on the docket, like, I'm going to rule on this case. And he's the only one that rules the other
right.
way. You
right.
know, this, it's not sustainable. And without us having faith in the Supreme Court, we have no faith in our rule of law. And without the rule of law, our system will completely devolve. I think what people have forgotten is that Congress is supposed to be a check on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is not supposed to be above all of us just ruling how they want, whenever they want. Congress is supposed to check the Supreme Court, and Congress hasn't checked the Supreme Court for a very long time. And right now, we're certainly not going to get Congress to check the Supreme Court because the House is run by Republicans. The Supreme Court is being ruled by a right-wing justices. So It's not going to happen. But long term, people need to think, okay, court reform has to be part of what I want. Court reform has to be part of what I ask my representatives to do, because it's the representatives that are going to have to do it. Yes, first, start with the most obvious, that there should be ethics violations if you're doing things like this. You shouldn't be able to be compromised. You shouldn't be going on cruises and trips and having your kids' education paid for. If someone paid for my kids' education, I would feel like I owed them something, right?
Yeah, I would. You think?
I would. And if and look, someone would and, like to pay for least, my kids' education, come on
at
down.
Least a dinner.
Here's the thing. It's just bananas, you know? But I think we do need to come up with solutions. We need to actually say, and I say this all the time, there are solutions. We just need to propose them, ask for them, and then demand them, right? Like, we have to move it through. So yes, of course, ethics. But I really do think we need court expansion. And I have said a million times that we could theoretically, if we flip the, if Biden was in power again and we flipped the House and we had the Senate, theoretically, we could say, hey, we're expanding the court to 13 justices to balance the amount of appellate court justices. There used to be 9. Now there's 13. We're just going to balance it out. And oh, guess what? The Democrats get to do those, you know, 10, 11, 12 and 13. We got 4 more justices and we win. Woo-hoo, right? It's now 7-6. We wouldn't win. Nobody wins if you make the court political. That's never going to work. We already see what happens. Right now, the court is political. It is a right-wing activist court. No one has faith in it. What did you say? 29% of the people have faith in it? So it doesn't work. So even if Biden could come in, theoretically, he was like, I'm going to go all in, which he would never do because he's a moderate. But if he said, I'm going to go all in and I'm going to use my Democratic House and the Democratic Senate and I'm going to expand the court to 13 and I'm going to nominate 4 new justices and now it's a liberal court, we still wouldn't have faith in the court because a Democrat put all those people in. So we can't make it political. So I am of the belief that we should either add term limits, because the Constitution does say you are there on the federal court for life, but it doesn't say you're there on the Supreme Court for life. So you could say you get 12 years on the Supreme Court and then you can go back down to the federal bench or you can retire.
Right.
Like, you don't need to stay on the Supreme Court for life. Nowhere does it say that, right? Secondly, I think we need to understand that the Supreme Court are not arbiters of everything the legislative branch does. So if the legislative branch, who represents 330 million voting Americans, says this is the law of the land, the Supreme Court has to be very careful if they're going to overturn that, because the legislative branch really is the branch that represents the people. And they are supposed to be, as they always say, calling balls and strikes.
Right.
So we need to be very careful with what they're allowed to rule on and what they're allowed to overturn. Thirdly, I would love to see court expansion to far bigger. I would love to see court expansion, I always say, to 27, because we could have 2 courts of 13, we could have 3 courts of 9, and then we could see so many more cases go through. Justices could take vacations. Justices could get sick. And I think that they should be picking their cases, essentially what I say, out of a hat, but I'm sure a computer algorithm would do it, where you didn't know what justices you were working with from case to case. You didn't know what cases you were going to get. So we couldn't have these situations where people are taking the case all the way to the Supreme Court because they know the result already. You know, Clarence Thomas is like, bring me gay marriage. That should not be, that is not justice. That's not justice being blind. But if I didn't know if I was working with Amy Coney Barrett or Justice Jackson from week to week, then people would have to bring their court cases to the Supreme Court on the merit of the case,
right?
As opposed to knowing they already had the justices in the bag. And I think that would go a long way to helping the public believe that the court once again was blind and they were really just ruling on the merits of the law.
Again, she passionately explains politics and makes it understandable and accessible. I don't know, that to me was a masterclass. And you know, I would take some exception. I don't think we should expand it that large. I do support expansion, probably to 13. I know there's a constitutional and political problem with that, in the sense that politically, whichever administration does that happens under, the politics will ensue, and constitutionally, you're going to have people sue, making the claim that, you know, there is no, it's not allowed under modern interpretation, which is a BS argument, but they'll make the argument anyway. But
which is
that
why
is
I push for a bigger butt, because I could say you get eight and I get eight,
right,
that kind of thing. Then which it is, would be fair.
Exactly. So we've just solved that Supreme Court problem.
This is
so
the point of democracy to disagree and solve.
You are aces in my book. I really enjoy talking with you and just, you know, listening to you. Just keep it simple, keep it real and fun and funny. One of the things I get a lot of, you know, when I'm doing MSNBC, a lot of folks say, it's a pretty heavy topic, but at the right moment, you made me laugh and you made me sort of not take it all so seriously. Well, you do that for me. You know, at the right moment, you make me chuckle and pause and think. And I hope a lot of people today got a chance to do a little bit of that.
Yeah. Well, we don't want our people drowning. We want them swimming towards a better future, right?
Yeah. Good stuff. Lee McGowan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. She is Politics Girl. Follow her on Twitter at I Am Politics Girl. The podcast, the Politics Girl podcast. Listen to it wherever you get podcasts. Like it, favorite, follow it. It's good stuff week in and week out. Really appreciate you coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, that does it for our time together now, folks. I love it when you stop by and spend some moments with me. Do that voodoo. You do so well when you download and share and love and like. Continue to do that. Have a good summer. It's hot as hell outside. So find yourself an ice cube and place it somewhere discreetly so you can cool your ass off. I'm Michael Steele. Until next time, take care.
Find an ice cube and place it somewhere.
's it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.